Good morning. It's 8:06, and of course, that means it's time for Erica Martin with the ABC Forecast Center to give us an update on what we can expect with our weather coming up this week. Good morning. How are you, Erica?
I am having some trouble hearing you. It seems that I'm hearing some kind of update from Donovan Mitchell, but I'm going to go ahead and do my best on what's going on here in Park City and in Summit County. Overall, a really nice stretch of weather ahead. We have lots of sunshine in the forecast. Keep in mind, though, that all that sunshine and dry conditions sometimes are is not the ideal combination simply because we do have issues with our drought monitor. So for today, we're going to see climbing temperatures, upper 70s and low 80s for tomorrow. So a very nice stretch ahead, clear skies. So keep in mind, we do have that radiational cooling, cooler nights ahead. Overnight lows for tonight, upper 40s to low 50s. Thursday, high in the low 80s. Overnight lows in the low 50s. Still trending pretty cool for those overnight lows. Friday, we're going to top out in the mid to upper 80s, and that's pretty much going to be the story for Saturday and Sunday. However, keep in mind, on Saturday and Sunday, we're going to see an increase in wind speeds and wind gusts. So it's important to note that we may see some red flag warnings issued for Park City, Summit County, etc. But this is overall going to be a lovely Labor Day weekend. Lots of sunshine in the forecast. Area of high pressure continues to hold. And then by Tuesday, we see a dip in those daily high temperatures back to reality as we approach the fall season. Lots of sunshine to start the following work week. Labor Day, of course, mostly clear skies, upper 70s, and then Tuesdays, upper 60s. So warm up and then a cool down, a sign that fall is indeed here and that the jet stream is cooperating. And we're going to see those cooler temperatures and hopefully some precip soon enough.
Thank you, Erica. It's 8:08, and you're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. Our first guest this morning will be Robbie Rems, who joins us to talk about his winning cocktail, which he comes from High West, and he will share with us, I presume, some of his ingredients and what inspired him to bring about this cocktail concoction. Well, two lawsuits related to the town of Hideout's controversial attempt to annex the Richardson Flat land east of Park City are scheduled to be heard in Utah courts in the coming days. KPCW's Sean Higgins has more.
Summit County has filed two lawsuits related to the attempted annexation of 655 acres of land in the county in an effort to prevent it from becoming a large commercial development area. Summit County sued the town of Hideout over their attempt to annex Richardson Flat on July 31st and also filed a second lawsuit against the developers hoping to build on that land, Nate Brockbank and Josh Romney, in late August. Summit County Manager Tom Fisher tells KPCW the county is alleging Brockbank and Romney attempted to purchase two parcels of land in Richardson Flat in an illegal foreclosure sale involving Wells Fargo Bank. Summit County says the sale was done improperly and should be invalidated by the court.
The lawsuit alleges that the foreclosure sale was done improperly because how it was handled by a constable. A constable that's not authorized in Summit County and it was from a different county, as well as the deeds that were prepared to memorialize that sale cannot be, we feel are illegal because they were prepared by this constable and that's not allowed in law.
Fisher says only a sheriff can conduct foreclosure sales in Summit County. He says constables are typically only used to serve court papers, such as a summons or subpoena to appear in court. Fisher says there is no authorized constable in Summit County. The county alleges Wells Fargo and the developer's attempt to use an unauthorized constable to push through the sale is evidence of Brockbank and Romney's effort to sidestep Summit County's zoning laws and regulations to obtain the property. Brockbank and Romney have also been tied to the lobbying effort behind the passage of a now-repealed state law, which paved the way for Hideout to begin the annexation of Richardson Flat in July, known as House Bill 359. The two parcels in question lie just east of the U.S. 189 and SR 248 interchange and are listed as SS 87 and SS 88 on the Summit County parcel map. According to the county's map, the parcels are currently still owned by the a United Park City Mines company. Fisher says the parcels were part of an agreement between Park City and the United Park City Mines Company during the development of Empire Pass in the early 2000s. That agreement says the parcels would remain development-free, however, different ownership of the parcels could change that. Summit County also alleges the two parcels were illegally subdivided into several smaller parcels surrounding an EPA-designated hazardous waste zone left over from Park City's mining town era. Fisher says subdividing the parcels around the waste zone would leave Summit County, the state, and the EPA the bill for the cleanup efforts.
They illegally subdivided that property through the sale into several different parcels, carving out the soils repository and leaving that to the EPA, Summit County, and the state to clean up without any without having the rest of the property available to fund some of that. So a couple of issues there, big issues there to Summit County and the citizens of Summit County.
A hearing for Summit County's lawsuit against Wells Fargo, Brock Bank, and Romney is scheduled for 9:30 a.m. on September 9th in Utah's 3rd District Court. A decision on Summit County's lawsuit against the town of Hideout over their attempt to annex Richardson Flat is scheduled to be handed down in Utah's 4th District Court at 3 p.m. on September 3rd. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
Well, good morning. It is 8:13, and of course you're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. And our first guest on the line is Robbie Rems with High West. He is joining us to talk about his winning cocktail. This is the end, I guess August 31st, ended the Park City Area Restaurant Association Summer Cocktail Contest. And Robbie, you're the winner. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me this morning.
Yeah, so let's talk about the name of your cocktail first. It's called Devil's Edition. Can you give us a little background on that and how you came up with that name?
Yeah, the Devil. So we have to use old Western names for our cocktails to keep it a theme of High West. And I just kind of look for something that kind of catches people's eyes. And Devil's Edition caught my eye. And it's just an old slang word for pretty much the red light district of the old mining days, which is kind of funny.
Oh, okay. Now, did you come up with that name before you came up with your mix, or did it happen in concert with that, or just?
No, so basically we make the cocktail. When it makes the menu, then we have to think of a cocktail name.
Okay. Now, how long did it take you to develop your concoction?
It takes a couple days for sure. We come into Bar Lab with an idea, and then we kind of work on it from there, and everyone puts their heads together, and you take one ingredient out, add another ingredient, and we all work with it together and everything.
Okay, and then... Go ahead.
Oh, and then we just think of a cocktail name after.
Okay. And when you say Bar Lab, tell us a little bit about what that is.
Yeah, so Bar Lab is, we basically come in to High West and like a day off or something, and you think of bringing an idea into the bar and make a drink and kind of see if it works or not, and then add an ingredient, take something out, add a little bit less simple syrup, more syrup, kind of stuff like that, a little trial and error.
Okay, and there's more than one of you in there, more than one bartender mixologist in there doing this at a time, or are you all competing with each other?
No, we never compete with each other. You kind of like, we'll go in and help each other out, actually. Like, if someone has an idea, I'll be like, hey, try this, or he'll say the same thing to me.
Okay, and of course it includes your High West double rye. It sounds like that's one of the main ingredients. But then you also add some other things. Are you able to divulge some of your ingredients in this? Is this a shared cocktail mix that you're going to let people know about, or do they have to come drink it themselves and try it out?
Oh, I can give them the recipe, but they also should come in and try it. It's an ounce of double rye, a half ounce Tanqueray gin. We put an ounce of matcha simple syrup in there, 3/4 ounce of pineapple juice, 3/4 ounce lemon juice, and topped off with soda water.
Okay. Yeah, and it also says some hops tincture.
Oh yeah, just like it's kind of like an Angostura bitter, just a hop tincture, hop bitters basically.
Okay. And there's another ingredient here that I'm not familiar with. It's called Cocchi Americano.
Yeah, Cocchi Americano. It's like it's an Italian white wine aperitif. Just a little quarter ounce in there.
Okay, just a little hint of that.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so what happens now that you're a winner?
Nothing really. Just go back to work and promoting the cocktails in High West.
Is there any kind of recognition that you get now, or that High West gets as a result?
What was that? Sorry.
Any kind of recognition that you or High West will get as a result?
I guess some bragging rights in town, but really that's about it. And I think they're trying to work on a bartender's box with the ingredients that you can get it delivered right to your door. But I'm not sure all the details on that.
Okay. Okay. And then how many other bartenders, mixologists compete in this event?
I think there was 17 total bars doing it.
Okay. And those are typically established restaurant association members that participate. So if I have idea about a good cocktail I know how to make, maybe I need to just save that for my friends and family. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think it's just with the restaurant association. I think it has to be part of a restaurant to be entered.
Okay. And then as far as just bragging rights, that kind of thing, it sounds like perhaps they'll feature you in a marketing campaign for the Park City Area Restaurants Association Dine About event.
I saw that last night. I didn't really know anything about that, to be honest with you.
Okay.
Until last night. And then it went a couple $100, which is nice.
Yeah.
For these times.
Yeah, absolutely. Anything else you want to say about your Devil's Edition winning cocktail?
Just thanks to everyone who voted and came in and tried it. I appreciate it. And come on in and still try it. It's still available until about the end of summer.
Okay, so kind of through the fall until the winter season comes online, and then you move on to something else. So let me ask this real quickly. Do cocktails, are they influenced by trends and styles in the way that maybe our clothing or, you know, our design of things? I mean, sweet, sour, spicy, that type of thing?
I think it's more the time of year, to be honest. Like, in the wintertime, you're not going to make a pineapple, like, light, refreshing drink. You'll make more of a stirred and strong whiskey-forward drink to warm you up. But in the summertime, you want something a little bit lighter, more fruity, a little bit, you know what I mean? So
yeah, makes sense.
Yeah, so it's more time of year, I feel like, not the trendy.
Okay. Well, we'll list the ingredients for the Devil's Edition on our KPCW website if anybody's interested. But is there another way for people to find this recipe?
Yeah, it's at on highwest.com. All our cocktails are listed there from years past and this year with photos and everything.
Okay, great. All right. Well, thank you. That is Robbie Rims. He is the winner of the Park City Area Restaurant Association Summer Cocktail Contest. Congratulations, Robbie. Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks for having me this morning.
You bet. Bye. It's 8:21. Well, it's been years in the making, but on Tuesday, some 20 years after a small military recreation hotel was torn down to make way for the 2002 Winter Olympics facilities at Snow Basin, a private developer has donated a five-acre parcel of property in Wasatch County on which he will build a new military conference hotel. It's at the base of the Mayflower Mountain Resort. Leslie Thatcher has those details. The Extel company, doing business as EX Utah Development, donated just under 5 acres of property to MITA, that's the Military Industrial Development Authority, for a new military conference hotel. This hotel will include some 387 rooms, 55 private residences, and 60,000 square feet of conference, food, and beverage facilities. This is just one of several hotels, condominiums, estate lots, and retail that's planned for the thousands of acres located just off the Mayflower exit on US 40 and at the eastern edge of Deer Valley Resort. With a long-term lease agreement signed with Deer Valley Resort that allows Deer Valley the continued use of leased ski terrain property owned by Extel, Extel has secured its right to a direct lift connection from the base of the Mayflower Ski Beach to the top of Deer Valley's Sultan Chairlift. Extel founder and chairman Gary Barnett, a New York-based developer, started acquiring the Mayflower property in 2014. Since then, he has amassed some 6,800 acres, which is all now part of the MITA project area. Working with MITA, Extel has secured special tax increment financing to begin building the resort's infrastructure. MITA is an independent, nonprofit, separate governmental body of the state of Utah. As an economic development entity, MITA has certain municipal powers and can issue bonds and capture tax increment to build on underutilized sites. Just last month, more than $68 million worth of assessment bonds were issued to Extel to begin building the resort infrastructure. Under the MITA terms, U.S. military personnel, active and retired, will have preferred rates at this conference hotel in perpetuity. In a press release, Extel announced that the location for the new conference hotel foundation has been cleared and primary infrastructure has started on the roads, water, sewer, and storm drains. The company is well underway to completing a voluntary environmental cleanup due to the former mining operations on site. Ski lifts serving the Mayflower Village are scheduled to open the winter of 2023, and the projected opening of the conference hotel is in 2024. You can find a link to the video from the developer about Mayflower Resort on our website, kpcw.org. Leslie Thatcher, KPCW News.
Well, Summit County Sheriff deputies and fire personnel responded on Saturday night to a brush fire in North Summit that was started by a target shooter. Rick Bruff has more.
Shortly after 7 p.m. on the 29th, deputies got the call about the fire in the Echo Ranches area. Sheriff's Lieutenant Andrew Wright said North Summit fire personnel also responded and contained the fire, which burned about 6 acres. Three parties were on site. A 27-year-old Lehigh man who was a co-owner of the property admitted he was shooting with his friends and he caused a spark that set off the fire. The county's current fire restriction order forbids target shooting. However, Lieutenant Wright said the group was cooperative. They also included a 29-year-old Cottonwood Heights resident who had called in the fire to dispatch and a 27-year-old man from Garden City, Idaho. The case will be forwarded to the county attorney's office for possible prosecution. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
Park City Police reported two automobiles stolen from an Old Town neighborhood last week. Both have been recovered as of yesterday. Police continue to patrol and ticket vehicles using the Prospector neighborhood to bypass traffic backups on Kearns. The two vehicles were reported stolen on the Thursday, August the 27th. A silver Infiniti QX80 was taken overnight from the 200 block of Daly Avenue. The other was stolen from the 100 block of King Road. It was a 2020 Subaru Forester SUV. According to Park City Police Captain Phil Kirk, both vehicles were recovered late Sunday night at the same location behind a building in the area of 200 East and 200 South in Salt Lake City. Kirk says he does not know if there are any suspects, but the investigation does continue. He told KPCW the victims were not able to say if keys had been left in the vehicles. He says they have no suspects at this point.
Yeah, they're both, you know, in front of their homes or in their driveways, and I would encourage people to be careful with securing their vehicles. We've had some other vehicle break-ins and burglaries, especially in the Old Town area, and majority of those are where cars are unlocked and valuables are left in them, and there were some valuables in at least one of these cars, too, besides that, some fishing equipment.
Last week, the Night Eyes Crime Prevention Program alerted residents on several occasions of potential vulnerabilities during officers' overnight patrols. They will try to contact homeowners to help them take precautions against theft.
somebody might have left their garage door open, and that means they're vulnerable to theft or burglary. And so we will notify the resident that, oh, hey, you left a bicycle on the front yard, or the garage door was left open, or something like that, that makes it easy for thieves to steal items from them.
Last week, they also made multiple traffic stops in the Prospector neighborhood, where it's common for vehicles to make illegal left turns from Kearns Boulevard onto Wyatt Earp Drive. Kirk says people use the neighborhood streets to avoid traffic jams on Kearns, but it is illegal to make that left-hand turn between 7 and 9 a.m.
And then we stepped up our efforts with school starting, but we were doing that quite a bit anyway, because then we had a lot of complaints from the residents and Prospector that it appeared that traffic was zipping through their neighborhoods to avoid the backup on Kearns due to the construction.
And delays on Kearns will likely continue through October, when the construction work is scheduled to take a winter hiatus. Well, good morning. It's 8:29, and next on our local news hour this morning, we have Park City Transit Manager Kim Felstead. She's on the line with, we've got Scott Burningham, who is also a transit service analyst. He's with the city as well. Both are on the line to talk about some changes to the transit schedules coming up for this winter season. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Kim, let's start off with you. Just looking through these details, it appears there's a pretty significant reduction, like up to 35% reduction in service. So how did the transit department make these decisions on which lines to cut or reduce, through the winter? Or have the decisions been finalized, and are you looking for input still?
The decisions have not been finalized, and we are seeking input. We currently have a survey available on our website. If you go to engageparkcity.org, you can take the survey all the way through Friday night. That's when it will close on the 4th. And the way that we recommended these changes, we look at all kinds of data points, ridership, our experience post-COVID right now has really changed our ridership. And we've had to adjust to that because along with that, we've had a significant loss in sales tax revenue, which is a large portion of how transit is funded in Park City. So we try to make the most of every dollar we do have and hit our high need areas. Unfortunately, that's not always pleasing to everyone involved, and it's hard for us not to have the resources to do all that's necessary. But we kind of use our best estimate given the variables at hand.
So there are a lot of unknowns. Vail just recently announced, of course, its decision to allow for, reservation-only skiing, which will reduce the number of people coming to town and the number of people on the mountain. And I suppose it will also impact the employees they hire. Now, Deer Valley has not announced anything yet, so we're not really sure on that. Are we jumping too soon to make these decisions and cuts until we know more about what's coming up in the winter?
I don't think we are, just based on the timeline that we need to actually execute the service. We typically staff up quite heavily in the winter. We're not anticipating needing to do that as much this winter, but we would still need to hire and train seasonal employees. So that can take 2 months easily to go through that process and, have a trained operator ready to go in time for the winter service. So we do have a little bit of lead time into these kind of decisions, but we have been in talks with a lot of the resorts. We've looked at a lot of different data points. We certainly wish we had a crystal ball, but nobody does. And so, looking at variables, how mobile people are right now, how much of a loss in ridership we've experienced to date with the pandemic, national trends, unfortunately, a lot of people are hesitant to get back on public transit because there's a perception that you're at higher risk to catch COVID. But that is not the case. There's numerous studies that disprove that, but perception is reality. And so we think it's going to take a while for people that are not transit dependent that have options to elect to come back to public transit. But we want to make sure we're here for them when that day comes.
Sure. Okay. And then let's open this up to Scott. Scott Burningham is, you're more of a numbers guy in terms of analyzing and making those considerations about which routes are most heavily traveled, which ones can be cut, which ones should be entirely eliminated or just services cut back. Can you talk a little bit about how you went about evaluating all of this?
Yeah, sure. Like Kim was saying, we did look at a lot of data points. We have automatic passenger counters on our buses, so we have a lot of historical data from our buses and from the past seasons. So we do use a little bit of the past seasons, even though we know this season will not be similar or won't be exactly the same. We can look at those and see where we have high ridership, what times of the day we have the ridership, and where there might be some redundancies where we could cut back. So yeah, a lot of those data points like Kim was talking about, we've looked at in making these decisions.
Okay, and the system that you have set up, this EngageParkCity.org, is that's the way people can give input about their feelings about particular routes and that type of thing. But what about all the people that aren't even here yet that probably come oftentimes without vehicles themselves and, you know, are just in for a season? How are you assessing that? Are you looking at last year's numbers, even though last year, of course, was a non-COVID time period?
Yes, that is certainly something we look at. We've also been in communication with a lot of the major employers in Park City to kind of understand what their plans are for hiring, and also share with them that we're doing this survey so that they can push it out to that employee base, because typically, you know, they remain in contact with them getting ready for the next season. So we've done everything we can to make sure we are reaching the people that are not here right now. But, you know, ideally, we're probably going to be reaching the local residents and businesses initially.
Okay, and the transit budget, the dollars allocated for your department, have those also been cut by 35%, or has that number not been finalized? I know they were going to revisit the budget this fall, but...
Right. It has been cut, not necessarily by 35%, but we were asked to take $1.2 million out of our operating budget because of a $5.4 million sales tax shortfall prediction, which is... been trending in that direction. And so this service option that we are putting out there is two-part. One, to help us meet our budget, but we're also trying to be as conservative as possible with the dollars that we have to ensure our future health. You know, unfortunately, this pandemic is not going to be a one-year situation where you just have to tighten, you know, down and save money for a year. We project we're going to be catching up from this for 3 to 4 years. So we want to make sure we're here in the long haul and responsible with those resources.
Sure. Okay. Well, let's kind of get into a little bit of the nuts and bolts here about what you're considering at this point. Two route suspensions, which include the Main Street trolley, and Three Blue, which wasn't that a new route that was offered last year or the year before?
Yes, that was a new route offered last year.
Okay. So those are the two that you're considering suspending entirely. And can you talk a little bit so Three Blue represents Thanes out onto 224, then through the Holiday Ranch Loop area, Park Meadows. And that's just a circular route that drops, that goes through the resort drop area as well.
Correct. And I'll let Scott speak to the logic of why the Three Blue. There's some redundancy that he can describe there.
Okay, great. Scott.
Yeah. The Two Green also goes through Park Meadows and Thames Canyon, but it starts out heading to Park Meadows first and then comes through Thames Canyon second. The Three Blue was put in place because the Two Green is a big loop. And so we're trying to help out to get people back to Thames Canyon a little quicker and also to connect those neighborhoods a little better. So there was some redundancy there that we see that the Two Green can cover both areas. It's just going to not be quite as convenient as it was last year.
Yeah, okay. And so you were trying to make the head times, I guess, like more like a 10-minute to move through those areas versus a 20-minute. Is that
correct? Last year, it did it helped out with those head times so that it was more frequent through those both those areas. So this will decrease the frequency of buses running through those areas, definitely. But it is covering that area.
Okay. And then, Scott, there are also some reductions, like 4 orange, 9 purple, 7 pink, 10 white, 2 green. These are not eliminations of the routes, but there's some changes to the hours that they'll operate. Is that right?
Correct. So, looking at the data, we do have definite peaks in our ridership. And so we're trying to serve those peaks. And therefore try to save, a little bit of money in doing that. So those peaks are usually between the hours of 6 and 10 and then between 3 and 7 in, every day. So with those peaks, we can actually save some money by just serving the greatest number of people.
Right. Carolyn, there is one exception on the 9 purple. We have 2 options there. One, to handle peak hour service or eliminate that route entirely, so that it has been in discussions.
Okay, and so the 9 purple, can you just give a descriptor of what 9 purple is then?
Yes, Scott, do you want to take that?
This service is one that goes up the MARSAC and it goes up to Empire Pass. So it mainly services the Montage and Empire Lodge up there at Empire Pass, but as well as some of those other lodges along the way.
Okay, and so you're saying that there's a consideration of eliminating that possibly?
Correct.
Okay. Now, it's an interesting thing. I've had J-1, visa workers come and stay at my home at different points in time over the years, and that was an interesting and difficult route because they actually worked at the Montage. So they had to be there at 6 a.m., and even when the bus was running, they couldn't get there to work on time. Has there been any discussion with the employers, about picking up some of the slack? Is that something that the city is going to consider and try to develop?
Yes, we have been in discussions with the employers in that area, and we have explored all kinds of options to try to work together to meet everyone's needs. I don't believe at this time most of the employers are in a position where they could handle that additional transportation beyond what they offer their guests. So the 9 purple is definitely kind of a difficult situation that we're still trying to find a remedy for.
Okay. What are the options when you do look at eliminating an entire route that, is really going to shut off? I mean, because the Main Street trolley, you shut that down, people can still walk up and down Main Street. You shut
right.
down the 3 blue, you've got that backup with the green. So, what do you do about that?
Yes, unfortunately, if we're unable to work through some kind of solution, then the employees are just going to have to find other means to get to work, which is not ideal. As transit professionals, we really hate to be in this kind of spot because we want to move people and we want to get them where they need to go. But unfortunately, we often deal with limited resources in that attempt. So, you try to take the most people to the most areas, and this route is just sort of an offshoot that does not have the ridership as some other routes have in town.
Yeah, sure. Okay. And then anything else in particular you want to point out that you're considering so people understand, like the 4 orange, 10 white, that's being considered to cut some service there. 10 white, of course, runs from town to the junction. Is that correct on the electric bus?
Correct. And that is a heavily used service. In the past, it's been at a 10-minute frequency. We have moved the frequency already, as of April because of COVID, but we want to continue to keep that at 15-minute frequency and then in the evening go to a 30-minute frequency. So, basically everyone can still, for the most part, get to where they need to go with these changes, just not as frequently. And it is more directed at our peak ridership. You know, in the past, Park City ran the same bus all day, you know, every 30 minutes or every 20 minutes. But you wouldn't have maximum efficiencies by doing that because, you know, the lack of riders in our off-peaks. So this is a change in dynamic for us to move to peak service. It's something other agencies do across the country. And I'm hoping that we don't, you know, lose any customers in this process, and we manage to find that sweet spot where we can still give people what they need. But it's really important to get that feedback. So I just, you know, want to reaffirm, please go to our website and fill out our survey. Additionally, we have something called the Joint Transit Advisory Board, or JTAB. That is a meeting that occurs every month with Summit County and City, Park City, and we talk about transit things. And so the next meeting is on September 15th at 9 in the morning, and that's where the survey results and these proposed changes will be discussed further. So people can participate in that meeting via Zoom, and that link is on our website under Transit and JTAB.
Okay, great. And when do you expect to make a decision?
We are hoping we have some pretty clear direction after that JTAB meeting on the 15th, because we do need to gear up and start hiring and heading in the direction we're going this winter. So it's a really crucial meeting.
Sure. Okay. Well, thank you. We're going to have to leave it there. That is Transit Manager Kim Feltsted and Scott Burningham. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Yeah, thank you.
Yes, it is 8:45, and don't forget, tune in live. Coverage from KPCW will be covering the Park City Miners football this Friday. We will broadcast the Miners versus the Uinta Utes live from Vernal this Friday, September 4th, starting at 7 p.m. KPCW will bring you all the hard-hitting football action and play-by-play of this and every game this season. Go Miners! Yes, it is 8:46. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. The home construction on Saddleview Way above the Snow Creek Shopping Center has caused controversy in recent months due to the home breaking over the nearby ridgeline. A public briefing on the issue has been postponed until after an appeal on the building permit is heard by the city. KPCW's Sean Higgins has the details.
Although construction on the home on Saddleview Way was approved by Park City Municipal over a year ago, city officials claim a clerical error is to blame for the building violating the city's ridgeline height ordinance. KPCW reported in July that the owners of the 955 Saddleview property did receive an elevation certificate from the city when the foundation of the home was laid in initial construction. Although the building plans did meet the city's overall height requirement, the city did not consider the ridgeline height ordinance. Park City's City Council requested a briefing on the issue at their next City Council meeting on September 17th, as well as a constituent briefing via Zoom by the end of August. However, Park City Municipal says the owners have filed an appeal of the approval of the building permit, and the briefing will have to be postponed until after the appeal is heard. Park City Planning Director Bruce Erickson tells KPCW the upper level of the home has been removed from the building permit, but the city and property owners are still working through other technical issues with the site.
The approvals given were that Lot 6, which is where this house sits, was approved and outside the sensitive lands, 150 feet setback from the ridgeline. And so it appeared that the height met the ridgeline requirements. And then the plat required that additional viewpoints be reviewed before a building permit was issued. So a second review of the sensitive lands.
Erickson says even though a review of additional viewpoints was required, there was nothing that indicated viewpoints from the south would be affected.
The viewpoints are all established west of the site. They're not necessarily established north of the site, so the only one north of the site is the park by the water treatment plant off Meadows Drive and the Olympic Park in the Barn Meadow. And so, you know, there's almost nothing that required a visual analysis from the south. So the planner at the time made the determination that the house met the height requirements and could proceed. And now we're trying to work through how we got here.
In a press release, the city did recognize the disappointment this situation has caused residents and said Park City Municipal is considering potential changes to the city's land management code to further clarify ridgeline and vantage point definitions. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
Well, it's 8:49, and our final guest this morning on the line, Executive Director of Summit Community Garden, Sloan Johnson. She's here to talk about fall activities in the gardens. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Kaylin.
So, first, it seems like this late in our summer, we are usually, I don't know, we've usually run into a few more cold nights than what we've had, which often threaten some of our more delicate plants, and I madly run out there every night covering things up to preserve them just one more week. So, but it seems like it has stayed quite warm and dry. Has that had any effect on the gardens out there?
Well, you know, this time of year we expect to start having to cover the garden again, the tomatoes and the squashes. So, yes, that is an expectation. And two nights ago, hopefully everybody covered their garden because it did get too freezing. If you do have plants, warm weather plants, such as tomatoes and pumpkins and different squashes, you will need to cover them. And we will be selling high altitude kits actually today at our farm stand from 9 to 11. If you don't have a frost cloth to cover your garden, you might want to purchase one if you want to save those late vegetables.
Okay, and frost cloth, is that different from using just a bed sheet or something of that nature?
Well, a frost cloth is nice. It does keep the frost off. A bed sheet does work. It also does let the sun in, so if you don't take it off during the day, it will let the sunshine in so the plants can grow as well.
Okay, so the frost cloth might be a better route if you're not pulling that off as soon as the sun comes up because it's
not quite as heavy also, so it's a little bit easier on the plants. But
sure.
If okay. You just have a sheet works. Anything you can use to cover them up and keep the frost off the leaves.
So tell us about events going on at the gardens.
The first thing I want to talk about is something we recently put together is our after-school program. So on Tuesday and Thursday, we will have after school in the garden. Tuesdays is more catered toward the first through third graders, and Thursdays is for the older kids, fourth through sixth graders. And we'll have different curriculums for each day. So you can sign up they start next week, so you can sign up for the whole 2 months. They end at the end of October, or you can just sign up for certain days. And we have lots of fun activities going on for the kids in the garden after school on Tuesdays and Thursdays. So that's something we're really excited about, and we look forward to having the kids in the garden again. We had such a great summer camp this year that we wanted to keep it going. And then as far as events coming up in the garden, on September 10th, we have our Red Desert Ensemble, and this is going to be really interesting. So the Red Desert Ensemble does kind of interactive music, and we'll have drums around the garden. You come, you can bring a picnic, or you can order online pizza that we will deliver to you in the garden. And then we listen to the music, and then you'll have the opportunity to participate in making music. And that's going to be a lot of fun. So definitely sign up for that. And then we have another dinner with details to come on September 24th. There's a new chop shop that is going to be opening in December, and they're putting together a dinner in the garden on September 24th.
Okay. And how do they do that? Do they prepare foods elsewhere and then truck it in, or what? How does it all work? Or are they working out there in the garden and cooking and grilling or that type of thing?
Yeah. So they bring stoves into the garden and, like a camp stove, and cook in the garden. I believe that they're going to be doing we have fire, like enclosed fire pits in the garden. I believe they're going to be doing some open fire cooking, but we'll have to wait and see. I don't have the exact details on what they're going to be serving yet.
Okay. And if you're interested in the after-school program, how do people sign up for that?
Yeah, so head to our website, summitcommunitygardens.org, and, you know, we have Gather, Learn, Grow. So go to Learn, and you'll see the after-school program. And, yeah, it's $30 for 2 hours. So all the programs are from 3:30 to 5:30. And so it's $30 for each one, or you can sign up for every single one. We also have scholarships available. So if it's something that you're interested in, but you know, it's not within your price range, please reach out, because we do have scholarship money available for these after-school programs.
Okay. And let me ask a little bit just about plants, perennials, that type of thing. I've heard that there are infestations of voles in our area, and that they eat the roots of our perennials. Well, that sounds like something that might have happened to me last year when I put in some new perennials. But what is the treatment? What's the natural way of dealing with that? I mean, obviously, you don't want to put down poison and that kind of thing. But I've heard that Milorganite maybe works because they don't like the taste of it. What do you recommend, and what do you guide the participants at the garden to do?
Yeah, well, voles, I don't think there's anybody who's gardened in Park City that has not experienced a vole problem. So that is definitely a large part of gardening in the mountains. And we definitely do not promote using any poisons. Like you said, Milorganite is a good option. They do not like Milorganite. There are many different deterrents that you can use. You can also plant garlic around your beds. They don't like the smells of certain herbs, like mint, which you have to be careful with because it'll take over everything, but maybe having mint in a pot nearby, that helps. That being said, once the goal is not to get the voles in, so using the deterrents prior to the voles coming, so thinking early. Usually you get a lot of vole activity in the winter when the snow is covering, and then in the spring when they're exposed, they kind of move out, and that's the time to really get the deterrents out there and then continue using them throughout the year, because once they're established in your garden, then it's much more difficult to get rid of them. But yes, many deterrents, but you can also buy deterrent spray. You can buy fox urine. Anything that has a strong smell that they don't like is very helpful.
Okay, and if you do have perennials, things that are going to come back year after year, do you treat in the fall also?
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, I would put Milorganite, or, you know, sometimes I use the cacao shells from Ritual Chocolate if you can get them to give you some, or, you know, anything that has a strong smell that voles don't like, put those around your perennials in the winter, like right before it snows, and that will help keep them away during the winter. Also, another great thing is they don't like to be exposed because there are a lot of predators. So if you kind of dig them out in the winter around them, then it'll keep them away as well. So they like to be just right under that snow is really nice space for them. So if you're digging out around your trees or your perennials, that'll help as well.
Sure. Okay. Well, anything else quickly? We're going to have to tie this up. We're moving into our next hour. Anything else you want to tell people about?
Well, thank you. We have our farm stand today from 9 to 11. So come on by and get some fresh vegetables and your frost cloth as well. And we look forward to seeing you all in the garden, hopefully for one of our events.
Okay, and just a reminder, where is the farm stand?
Oh, so the farm stand is at the garden, and that's right next to Matt Newt Park on Shadow Mountain Drive. just across the parking lot from that new.
Okay. Well, thank you. That's Executive Director with the Summit Community Gardens, Sloan
thank
Johnson. Thanks for joining us. Bye now. It's 9 o'clock. You're listening to KPCW Park City. Thank you for joining us this morning. Stay, though, because the Mountain Life is coming up right after the NPR News headlines, and that will be hosted by Lynn Ware-Peak and Pete Stoughton.